The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined again by Victor Davis Hanson, who is a historian, classicist, and commentator in the American media and in the international media, indeed, because you're on this Americano podcast, after all. And we're going to be talking about your book, your new book, which is called The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. And it is also, to pinch the title of your epilogue, about how the unthinkable becomes the inevitable. And in the book, you look at various annihilations, the annihilation of the Thebans at the hands of Alexander the Great, the demise of the Carthaginians at the hands of Scipio and the Romans, the fall of Constantinople and the end of the Byzantine Empire at the hands of the Ottomans, and the destruction of the Aztec civilization at the hands of the Spanish conquistadors and Hernan Cortes. While reading this book, I kept thinking, because the last time I spoke to you was we talked a lot about Donald Trump on the campaign. He says quite a lot this year that we're closer than ever to World War III and sort of insinuates that some great destruction is at hand. And at the end of your book, you touch on this. You talk about the various conflicts that we have in the world today. In Ukraine, obvious, is the obvious one. You have a more belligerent China and China's threat to Taiwan. You have North Korea, of course, which is often saber-rattling against the world. You have the possibility of a nuclear Iran. You have the war in the Middle East. And there are plenty of other potential conflicts that could result in a civilizational destruction. And we tend to reassure ourselves now that nuclear missiles, the possibility of nuclear catastrophe, means that we have, because of the theory of mutually assured destruction, we are a bit safer than we are. But your book rather keenly points out that we're not. I mean, what do you think of the theory of mutually assured destruction? I thought I'd start by asking you that.
Well, I should say as a preliminary that the actual extinction of a civilization as opposed to its defeat or surrender is pretty rare. And I'm not talking about, you know, the carnage inflicted by a Tamerlane, Genghis Khan, or Attila the Hun. These are more planned scientific erasures of the language, the physical space, the people, the culture, the religion. But it does happen. And some of the commonalities of the case studies that I chose, and there were more that I could have, is the naivete and the denial and a lack of a rational assessment of the targeted resources versus the aggressor's resources and the nature of the aggressor. And part of that is because all of these targeted doomed cities and empires were accustomed to being preeminent and they didn't make a rational calculation. So given that paradigm, when you look at the modern world, the United States has this idea that as a creator of the post-war world, it's preeminent, and that preeminent is by construct rather than continual reinvestment. By that I mean we're 40,000 soldiers short in our recruitment now. We never had that fewer soldiers. Most of them, almost all of them, are from the demographic of white males who feel that the military is DEI or whatever. But they do die at twice their numbers of the demographic in Afghanistan and Iraq. So it's a very important demographic, and yet they're not joining. We have 7 years to replace Javelins. China's building 5 ships per year for each one that we are. We're borrowing $1 trillion every 100 days. I could go on, but what I'm getting at is that then given these disturbing trends, that, and one of the most, I think Neil Ferguson pointed it out, but he's absolutely right, we are spending more to service the debt, about $800 billion a year than we are on our defense budget. And that's often a very valuable rubric when you assess decline. And yet we don't act as if we are, even in the face of the symptoms abroad. If you look at the Afghan pullout, $50 billion handed over to the Taliban and munitions. If you look at Joe Biden saying the reaction to Ukraine would depend on whether it's a minor or major invasion, or telling Mr. Putin that our reaction to cyber warfare would depend on whether he hit hospitals or not, and he had to stop hitting hospitals as if it was okay to hit anything else. The Chinese balloon that traversed the continental United States for 7 days with impunity. So there's a lack of deterrence, and then there's a sense that maybe that lack of deterrence reflects that for all of our rhetoric, we're not as prepared militarily, economically, financially, culturally, socially as we have been in the past, and we're in denial. And it doesn't really matter what we feel, it's the sense that we project. So when you look at the world today, why did Vladimir Putin, we've had four successive administrations. There was only one that he didn't leave his borders, and that was 2017 to 2020. He went into Ossetia under a crippled Bush administration and Georgia. He went in under Obama into Donbass and Crimea. He tried to take Kiev during the Biden administration. Why did Hamas stage the October 7th? Why did they choose to do that? Why did China decide that all of a sudden the last 2 years they were going to up their rhetoric about Taiwan? So it's based on this reality that they sense that we either cannot or will not respond. And they look at the West in general. It's not just an American phenomenon. NATO countries, just there's only about 20%, only with cajoling do they up their military investments by up to 2% of GDP. And there's a sense of malaise in the West that they can't tell people this is a sovereign state, these are sovereign borders, you must come legally, you must assimilate, integrate, you left your home, we didn't ask you to come, you wanted to come, you're going to be a citizen of a Western democracy. So there's a paralysis, almost as if Livy, who said the proposed remedy or the medicine is worse than the disease. We know what we have to do, but we feel that to do that would cause such social, cultural turmoil that our leaders don't want to face it. One of the things, you mentioned all of these contemporary challenges. One of the strangest was what's happening to Turkey. In fact, of all the presidents or leaders who have threatened existential destruction, he has the most targets. He has said that the Athenians would wake up one morning, Athens, and see a range of rockets descending from Turkey over the dispute of the Dodecanese Islands. He said to the Armenians, after he ethnically cleansed, or he ordered 200,000 Armenians from Karabakh and Azerbaijan, he said, we're going to handle the Armenian problem the way that our grandfathers did. He's told the Kurds that they're not really a people. But most disturbingly, during the coup of a few years ago, he announced that the nuclear weapons, that the American nuclear weapons, Cold War big dirty bombs, I think there's 50 of them at Incirlik Air Force Base near the Syrian border. He said, these have been here so long, they're really proprietary Turkish arms, and we do not want the United States to remove them. And when that coup took place, they shut down that airport, as you remember. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense that all of these actors or players feel there's a weakness in the West in general, and particularly in the United States, and they feel that this is a golden opportunity to be aggressive. And they're very sensitive to it as well. When I wrote the book, I only had two sentences about China threatening existential destruction against Taiwan and Japan. And I've had a pretty good market in China for military history books. I've written the Second World War, which sold very well. And they wrote basic books and said, you either remove that line referencing us, or we're not going to translate this time. And I couldn't do that. So they canceled the Chinese translation. So these powers are very sensitive to that, and they know what they're doing. And yet we don't seem to be able in the West to marshal enough wherewithal to reestablish deterrence.
It's very striking what you say about China in your book. I think next week, or perhaps the week after, Xi Jinping is going to go to Serbia. And he's going to give a speech, I believe, on the site of where the Americans accidentally bombed the Chinese don't think it's accidental, but it almost certainly was, I think, where the Americans bombed the Chinese embassy in Serbia in 1999. that's a clear statement from Xi Jinping, that, and it's a clear sort of incitement to anti-Americanism, isn't it? Which does seem to be his strategy on the world now.
It is. And he looks at certain things and he sees asymmetry. He sees 300,000 Chinese students. If only one, the FBI says several thousand of them are engaged in espionage. But if only 1% was, you can see it's several thousand. And we have 250,000 students from the Middle East that are on student visas here. And in the case of this Columbia unrest, 1/3 of all Columbia students are foreign students. Why is that? Because these universities have jacked up the tuition higher than the rate of inflation for 30 years. They're far too expensive, and they charge only foreign students a premium. They have to pay the full cost, and that's what they rely on to subsidize their fellowships to American students. And it's a very unstable situation when you have so many people coming into the United States from autocratic or illiberal regimes, and yet you would think they would be so happy to enjoy the freedoms of the West in a Western country, but instead they look at that magnanimity as weakness to be exploited, and then they either praise the illiberal regime that they do not want to go back to, and that's, I'm being literal there, they're, on our campuses they're praising Hamas now and Hezbollah, but they don't want to leave, and so it's almost as if they're saying to us, you people are so stupid that we're going to take advantage of all of your freedoms and decadence, and we're going to enjoy ourselves here while we cheer on your very destruction. And then when you say to them, as I have, well, then you would have nowhere to go if you obviously wanted to leave your country. And I guess their answer is always, we're going to make an enclave inside the West where we're going to have the larger free market capitalism and freedoms, but within our community that will be unassimilated, we can replicate Jordan or Gaza as an autonomous island, but sort of suck or absorb or draw off all of the benefits of the West without participating in it. And I don't think Western governments see that danger at all.
There's obvious signs that China and Russia, they look at, you know, protests, campus protests like the ones that are going on at the moment across America, and they see decadence. They see an opportunity in that decadence. Is that not right?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I don't think they see so much the opportunity of the politics, or they enjoy it immensely, the anti-Americanism, the pro-Hamas, the anti-Semitism. But what they really enjoy and they really feel is indicative of the status of America is, I guess, what I would call the cry-bully youth. And that is these youth who parade around as if they're 1917 Bolsheviks, and then they want the university to supply them food. Or when they're arrested, they start screaming and yelling and crying and go into a fetal position. Or we had in Bakersfield, not far from my farm here, we had one of these people who went to the Bakersfield City Council and threatened all of them with death and said that she would meet them at their home and kill them, pro-Hamas person. And then when they indicted her 3 days later on 18 felonies, she broke into tears. And when the Chinese look at this crybaby generation, they think, wow, these are the people that we enjoy. If this is what the West is, a bunch of would-be revolutionaries, they're not even like our Red Guard. These people are, they're not just play acting, but they're easily manipulated by activists from the Middle East. They're not very well educated. They're ignorant and they're crybabies and they're afraid and timid. And they're bullies, and this is the elite of America, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. So I think that gives them great reassurance and emboldens them.
You talked in your first answer about projecting strength, but when one hears those words, one does think about the times America has attempted to project strength in recent decades, and it hasn't gone well. Iraq, Afghanistan,
yes,
being the two foremost examples. Is the tragedy of Americans' foreign policy of the last 50 years, is it that when it has tried to project strength, it's either got the wrong occasion to do it or it's done it terribly? And now nobody, well, very few people in America really want it to project strength on the world stage anymore.
I think a good paradigm of what you're saying is you look at Israel when it halted the final destruction of Hamas. It was very indicative of Vietnam, what they're going to be into. And let's say, I think you were being kind to us because you could have added Libya bombing, for example. The only really situation where we performed war well in the last, since World War II, was we did save South Korea, we being the West, with a prominent role of the United States. And then we did, in the first Gulf War, get Saddam out of Kuwait. We botched the Newman of that. But there has to be an exegesis for all that. And I think the problem is that in a postmodern society that's affluent and leisured, it's very hard to use the amount of existential force that traditionally throughout war achieves disproportionate force and victory. And then you defeat the enemy on the battlefield, you humiliate the enemy, and then from a position of weakness, the enemy asks you for terms, and you dictate them. But that's antithetical to a postmodern society. So we're very good about destroying things, and we can defeat them, especially if we in the West use our force on Western terms. We do not want to go into Fallujah or Mosul and fight on non-Western terms. But if we keep away from that and use air power, sea power, conventional forces, we're very good. But then when it comes time to destroy the enemy, we back off because that's contrary to our sense of decency or social ethical progress, and then we cause more mayhem. I have a little bit of optimism, and that is the neoconservative nation building is over in the United States. I think the isolationism is over, and what's emerging is a Jacksonianism, no better friend, no worse enemy. And we saw glimpses of it during the Trump administration, and it was very effective. I mean, he made no apologies that he was going to bomb the proverbial SHIT out of ISIS. He did that. He got rid of them in 6 weeks. He was pretty ruthless if you go back and look at the actual bombing. He didn't really worry about if they were hiding in enclaves, he blew up the enclave. He got rid of General Soleimani. They told him he couldn't do that. All hell would break loose. He got out of the Iran deal. For all the talk about Russian collusion that was, I think, a complete farce, he upped the sanctions on oligarchs. He got out of an asymmetrical treaty with Putin. He sold javelins to the Ukrainians. He flooded the world with cheap oil to hurt Putin. He campaigned against the pipeline. So I think that type of foreign policy, I think Michael Pompeo was pretty effective. And it wasn't, we're going to try to change your heart and minds, or we're going to go in the Middle East and we're going to establish an Iraqi democracy. It was more, we can't do anything, and we have a limited number of allies, Australia, the English-speaking countries, Japan, South Korea, the NATO countries, and we're going to protect them, and we're not going to get involved anywhere else because we don't have the wherewithal, and we're not psychologically prepared to do that, and we're not going to try to tell these countries how to live, or they're illiberal, or they don't meet our expectations of social good. They're our allies for better or worse. And you could see that with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia. And Joe Biden said that it was a pariah state, that he was going to ostracize it. Came in, he did just that, tilted toward Iran, and then within 18 months, he was scurrying to Riyadh to apologize because he understood geostrategic reality. Mm. So that is optimistic that there's talk in the United States that the United States has to rearm, and when it rearms, it has to get a cast of characters in the State Department and the Pentagon that will use force very carefully and targeted, and only in the cause of U.S. interest and its allies' protection. Mm. And I think that's much wiser. I've talked to a lot of people in the Trump circle, and I think a lot of it, people misunderstood that administration because it was almost the Nixon tactic that Kissinger said that Nixon acted like he was crazy, and then he called in Kissinger to tell people. And Trump really thought that would be effective, that if people around him thought he was unpredictable. And then when he said crazy things, Michael Pompeo came in and reassured everybody that this is what, but it did get people off balance like Putin and Kim Jong-un. So I think that's a wise change in American foreign policy. It's deeply resented here by the bipartisan establishment and the bicoastal elite, but we're getting to a consensus, I think, among the people that we're going to be a lot stronger and we're going to be a lot more confident in picking allies that we support because they are from the same traditions. And we're not going to try to go in there and get in these god-awful places and try to convince people who hate us that they should be like us. It's just not going to happen.
I sometimes wonder, and I'm only half joking, whether there is an advantage to Biden's apparent senility in the sense that he's almost as unpredictable as Trump in some ways, because when he talks about Taiwan, for instance, he's quite often said we'll go to war with China over Taiwan, and then the State Department has to issue in a clarification that he didn't mean that, et cetera, et cetera. So can there be something advantageous about having not a madman in charge, but a doddery old man?
If it's true unpredictability, you're quite right. And sometimes that's an advantage for Biden. But my worry about Biden is that the unpredictability is always resolved by a lack of deterrence. So when he talks tough about Putin, then he sends a signal that Ukraine is not to hit Russian oil facilities, because to do so would raise gas prices before the election. Or he talks tough to Iran, and then Anthony Blinken goes over and says, well, it's okay for you to respond to the targeted assassination in Damascus as long as your response is within limits. And what he should have said was, you're at the source of all the violence for the last 30 years in the Middle East. You're the source of the Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, etc. And we don't know what Israel is going to do. So if you want to go hit them, you go ahead. But there's no restrictions on our part on what they're going to do to you. And I would warn you that your missiles, if you send them, will not touch Israel, because we're going to help defend them. We're not going to help on the counterattack, but we don't care what they do to you. And I think if he had said that, Iran would have had a very different attitude. And the other problem I have with it, I think you're quite right about unpredictability. It's a very valuable asset. But the other problem is, I think there's a perception here in the United States and abroad that his unpredictability is being used by people from the prior administrations. Most of the people around him are from the Obama administration. And people feel that the Obamas, who are the only ex-presidential family who stayed in Washington, D.C., for the most part, they are running things, the agenda on the border, the agenda on appointments, the agenda on the Nobel, that comes out of the Obama philosophy. And the same thing, no sooner did he come in to office than he really destroyed this idea of the Abraham Accords, getting out of the Iran deal, saying the Houthis were terrorists, cutting off Hamas. He just reversed all of that, and it was almost identical to the crazy Obama idea of creating strategic tension by favoring or leaning Iran and then playing them off against the Saudis and Israel, and then going back and forth and using one against the other rather than identifying with those who have more of our interest than the other.
Going back to the theme of annihilation and your book, something that comes up a lot is technology.
Yes.
The invention of a new technology can trigger a devastating conflict. And obviously, people talk about AI a lot, and that does have the potential. One can see the potential there for catastrophic warfare from that. But I wonder just, you know, is not the technology that has changed things already the internet? We are still reeling with the consequences of the internet, and we don't quite know the effect it's having on our own societies, on our own stabilities. Are we not already living through that moment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the average American youth spends about, I think it's 11 hours on their iPhones per day, and we have no idea where they're getting their information, but a lot of it is unfounded and deliberately misleading. And they're not in that 11 hours, they're not doing it, they're not reading, they're not, and you can see it with the students when they scream and yell from the river to the sea. And I'm on the Stanford campus, it's supposedly an elite campus, so when I ask them, what does the river mean and what does the sea mean, I think, you know, they'll walk up to you and say, shame, shame, if you walk by them without encountering them. And yet they don't have no idea the Mediterranean is, they don't know where it is, they don't know what the Jordan River is, they don't know anything about Israel. So it's a sin of commission of what the internet does, but it's a sin of omission what they should be doing if they weren't glued to the internet. The thing about technology, I mean, human nature doesn't change. So what this technology, nuclear bio, as we saw with COVID, the destruction of virus, an engineered virus, can do, chemical and AI, is it it reduces the margin of error, so that these are more instantaneous. And that was your point, I think, about the internet, instant global communication. So misinformation can just spread so fast to 8 billion people. But human nature hasn't caught up with it. And the problem I think we're having is that because human nature hasn't changed, that in the past, when you wanted to destroy Tenochtitlan or Carthage, you had to use muscular labor, and that was a difficult thing. It took 3 years to destroy Carthage. It took 2.5 months to destroy Constantinople. So there were time for the defenders to adapt. They didn't do it very well, but today, you can do it in a second. And in the book, I mentioned AI, where there was a notorious Pentagon example where they did a computer simulation of AI, and they said, we're going to launch a missile at a target on our computer, and we're going to put every known AI prompt to protect that missile so it gets to the target, whether that be evasive maneuvers from anti-aircraft or destroying anti-aircraft or swerving or changing the trajectory. And it was working wonderfully, and then it was time to stop the simulation, and the computer operator hit the kill button, and it didn't kill it. The AI had already developed, so it turned around and went backwards to kill the person at the computer terminal. And they stopped that experiment and thinking, we don't want to go down this road. And again, AI, all of these things are based on the human people. So AI is coming out of the minds of people in Silicon Valley. And unfortunately, I work right next to them at Stanford University. I'm not confident in either their morality or their judgment. And yet these people are programming these very sophisticated prompts.
There's a fascinating bit in the chapter on the Aztecs where I think it's sort of almost a case of familiarity breeds contempt, because the first encounter between the Spanish and the Aztecs, or the first encounters, they are aliens to each other.
Yes.
It's about as close as you get to sort of interplanetary contact in history. And yes. They initially are not particularly hostile, it seems. And so the Aztecs seem to think they're gods and so on. And it's only as they get to know the Spanish and they see that actually they're just greedy and they want gold that they start to be particularly violent towards them. And on that point, I think there's perhaps something paradoxical about the internet, which is that, yes, it is destructive in all these ways, but familiarity doesn't always breed contempt. And in all the examples in your book, you're talking about civilizations that didn't know each other, wiping each other out. And I don't want to sound overly optimistic, but we just don't have that anymore. We don't have that total lack of empathy or understanding of another culture or civilization.
I think that's a valid point. The only problem I have with it is very dangerous, I think, dangerous illiberal regimes that have agendas that are antithetical to the West have a veneer of Westernization, and that tends to make them familiar to us. I'm thinking, of course, of the CCP, TikTok, and 300,000 students here. And I just say that because a beloved lecturer, a neuroscientist lecturer at my university, who was involved with the Confucius Institute, we found out was a Chinese, actually not a spy, but a member of the Chinese army, and was here for that purpose. And that's happened a lot. And so I think we in the West, and I don't have the answer to this, but I think you have a very valid point, and I don't know who is right, but there seems to be a creative tension going on where, just to take the Chinese example, they're sending 300,000 people to America. We think, because a large percentage of them, almost 10%, 30,000 stay here. They apply for permanent residence, and if they're in medical school, they do it because of the chance of being part of the elite income bracket. But my point is that we feel, look what we did to these communists. They came over here, and now we have this very loyal group to America because they're doing so well, and they know all about communist China, and they're telling us about it, and we've got Chinese speakers, and we're kind of undermining China and globalization. They think that they're stealing technology, but we're giving them Snoop Dogg and all this other stuff, and it's making them more like us than we are like them. And that's the one view. And then the other view is, no, they use that veneer to keep us off our guard. And I'm just thinking of Fong Fong. You may have remembered the Chinese spy.
Oh, yes.
Who was sleeping with Eric Swalwell and getting information. Well, I wrote a very critical op-ed about China, a number of them. And I got a call about 8 years ago from the Chinese consulate in San Francisco and said that you are incorrect. You're a Japanese militarist stooge, the whole thing. And then I want to talk to you. So this, I thought she was driving down from San Francisco, but she was actually outside my office door and she came in and I didn't know who it was, but I thought it was suspicious. So I had both of my assistants there with me. And this woman came in with boots and skin tight Levi's and kind of her sunglasses tucked in her open blouse, very plunging, and with all these gifts, and said I was incorrect, with a very strong Chinese accent. And finally, I just said, this is ridiculous. And, you know, get out. And then she dropped all of that, and she got into a valley girl, and she said, I went to Cal State Hayward, man. Hey, man, you're an idiot, you know, man. Obama lets us in China do everything we want. We go into Japanese airspace. You can't do shit. Excuse me, but that's how the way she was talking.
Yeah.
And I just wrote her off as an insignificant. And then about 5 years later, one of my assistants called me and said, that's Fang Fang that was in our office. And so she was making the rounds of the Bay Area in those days with politicians, think tanks, and she could turn on what I'm saying, the Valley Girl, I'm Americanized, I'm a Cal State graduate, and then quickly go back into I'm a Chinese operative. Mm. And I think there's a lot of people like that. So one thing I'm worried about, maybe you would disagree, but I'm worried that in especially America, we have this idea that Middle East students come over here and foreigners come over here. We have, by the way, the largest number of non-native born American residents in history, both in numbers and percentage wise. 15% of the population, 55 million. And we think that they look at rap, or they look at our universities, or they look at our popular culture, or they look at the affluence, and they think this is wonderful. And yet we can't conceive, because they want to come over here, that they interpret this as decadence, or that we don't look at these people, they have a third gender, or they have partial birth abortions, or they have homeless people injecting on the street. But yet when I talk to people, and I get that impression that, and you really could see that with the 9/11 suicide hijackers, they came over here and they indulged themselves in Vegas, strip shows, gambling, drugs, and then they reacted to what that was doing with them by destroying it. And almost every mass killing in the West from someone from the Middle East, whether in Europe, the United States, you start to investigate the background, and it's a person who, Bin Laden is a good example, had at one point in their life submersed themselves in Western culture and then resented it or felt that they had to react against that aberration. So I don't think we in the West understand globalization, and we think everybody's got antibiotics, they have glasses, they wear glasses in the Amazon, they wear jeans in Lebanon, they're just like us. But that's a veneer that they find attractive, but they also existentially hate what that does to them and their traditional societies, and they blame us for it. And so I was somebody who, you know, I'm all for immigration, but only legal, measured, diverse immigration that the population can be vetted, assimilated, and integrated. And I think otherwise, illegal, large, non-diverse, unassimilated immigration has been a disaster for Western countries.
You're talking there about how other cultures sort of can enjoy Western decadence. They appreciate it because they can see that it's decaying. Do you not think we ourselves have an element of that? We enjoy our own cultural decadence, and that leads us on to sort of the partner in crime of annihilation, which is civilizational suicide.
Yeah, I think so. And that's something that I'm by trade a classical linguist, so I've read, you know, I taught Greek and Latin languages and philology for 20 years, but that's a theme throughout Greek and Roman literature, that criticism, self-criticism, is a great Socratic advantage of the West. We always tear apart, we improve, we listen to different ideas, but at certain periods it intensifies and it becomes nihilist. So when you start reading Tacitus, for example, or Petronius or Suetonius, you see that it's going a little bit too far. And it ends up hating the very system that gives them the affluence, the leisure, the security to be self-critical. And then we have the other advantage, but also contradictions of Christianity, that you do it when you have a religion that is Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek, blessed are the meek. It's a wonderful enrichment of Western culture, but when it combines with the rational self-criticism and the pacifism, then you can get a laxity or an inability to realize what made you affluent. And that's what's happening in the postmodern West. We have a bunch of young people who, because they don't have to work all day long, or they don't have to study 12 hours a day. And it's very recent. I know as a graduate student at Stanford, when we were classic students, we used to go into garbage bins and find cast-off wood so we could go back to our $50 a month apartments and build, you know, bookcases for all the used books we were buying. And that just seems like a different world today. And I'm speaking on a farm I grew up, and the idea that we would free-range kids today, where your parents would just say, okay, it's Saturday, you do your chores, and then we're going to let you range around 180 acres on your own and take care of yourself. After all, you're 8 years old, you should be an adult. That's gone in the West. And so we have this, it really bothers me to see, unfortunately, when I see students at Stanford that are so wealthy and so pampered, especially many of them from different countries, and then yet they're so critical of the very system that allowed their families and themselves to be enriched and all of this freedom, and they hate it. But as you see, they don't, when you look at these protesters, to take that example, they don't hate it enough to disconnect from it. They want to despise the country that has done so much for them, or the system, and yet they never say to themselves, wow, I can stand out in the free speech area because some poor kid that was 18 years old decided to land on Omaha Beach and was shot in the head the second he did. And the next guy, and the next guy, and the next guy, and the eighth person finally got to the seawall. Or, wow, somebody, my great-great-grandfather or my grandfather was in a B-17 or a Lancaster bomber, and they hit a rail yard that stopped the genocide for a day or two, and my God, they all got blown up by flak. So nobody thinks like that. They just go back and they use contemporary morality to judge prior generations on their own standards. And they're completely oblivious. When you talk to them, you say to them, the West was the first society in the world. The British Empire outlawed the slave trade and outlawed slavery. And they were the only country to do that. That was not just a Western phenomenon, and all countries had slaves. The Islamic world had more than the Western world, but they eliminate it. They're not capable of seeing any good. They don't look at it. It's either all or nothing. And if you don't appreciate your past or your traditions and you condemn these people, then two things happen. You become sort of ingrates, and you don't understand why you're so lucky. But more importantly, you're so narcissistic, you don't understand what people are going to say about you. And so I always say to these students, so 40 years from now, we may have a reactionary period where people go back to what worked, and they're going to look at you guys, and they're going to say, wow, you left 1 million people inject, fornicate, urinate, and defecate on your streets like it was medieval Paris or something. And then you had 10,000 partial birth abortions where the infant was viable and had to be killed in the birth canal. Or you let 100,000 American youth kill themselves with fentanyl and you wouldn't stop it. And they're just oblivious that the future generations will say that about them. Or will say, you know, you reintroduce Jim Crow on your campuses. So now we have segregated dorms by race, segregated graduations by race, segregated safe spaces by race. No different than if you were a neo-Confederate. And now you're wearing masks. Instead of Klan masks, you're wearing these Palestinian scarves. But the same purpose is to commit violence and to be empowered by being anonymous. And so, yeah, I'm very worried about that. I think all of us are, that this valuable self-criticism has accelerated the point of nihilism and self-loathing. Oikophobia, I think a great scholar has recently, Benedict, he had written a book called Oikophobia. It's the same. It's a very good argument.
Well, the self-criticism element, I suppose that's an important part of conservatism, isn't it? And the cover of your book is the Destruction painting by Thomas Cole, which is an American painting of a sort of Roman scene of destruction. And that's always been an important part of the American psyche, is it not? You have the optimism, but you also have this sense that it's very precious and it can be destroyed and we're likely to destroy it ourselves.
Yes, you're right. It's what makes us great, but it taken to excess, it's nihilistic and it'll destroy us. You have to transmit the Western cargo every generation. It's like a big chain. If you have one link that's weakened, the whole thing collapses. So we can lose our culture very quickly. And I'm just appalled when I talk to Stanford students how little they know. I mean, I know that sounds sort of like an old grouchy Roman where, you know, our generation had to do this and the next one is decadent. But there's something to that four or five generations, if you graduated with a bachelor's degree from Harvard or Yale or Princeton, you were an elite. You knew what the Pythagorean theory was. You knew what a Doric column was. You knew the difference between Lincoln and Andrew Jackson. You knew what started the Civil War. They don't know any of that today.
Yeah.
They, the majority of students. And they surely don't know anything about civic education. And, you know, they'll just have students will talk to you and say, oh, we're going to get rid of, we've got to pack the court. We've got to get rid of the Electoral College. We've got to get rid of the filibuster. You say, well, it's a 160-year tradition. Or the you know why Hamilton and people wanted an Electoral College? They don't know anything.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous because that's the elite. I think one observation is that there's been a sea change here in America about what constitutes elite education. And because of two things, these constant protests and then the admissions policies to these universities that are racial, say in the case of Stanford University, they dropped the SAT exam and they decided after George Floyd, the last 3.5 years, they were only going to let in 20% of the student body that was white, even though that's 68% of the demographic. And to do that, they were letting in students who, by their own standards of just 5 years ago, would not be able to do the work that they considered was necessary to keep their preeminent place in American education. So now on these campuses, and we're not unique, the faculty is either inflating the grades, so 80% of students at Yale, for example, get A's or A minuses now, or they have to introduce new courses that are therapeutic, or they have to water down. And if you don't do that, then we have these thousands of these DEI czars that will report you as systematically racist or biased or something. So my point is that, and then when you collate that with the violence and all of the foreign students at these elite universities and the endowment income of these multi-billion dollar endowments that's not taxed and the $2 trillion student loan, there's a lot of people just coming to the conclusion that a bachelor's degree from Princeton or Harvard is not prestigious anymore. You better go to Georgia Tech or Vanderbilt or Texas A&M or the University of Tennessee because the courses they still require SAT scores. The faculty is not weaponized. The students are studying. There's no anti-Semitism. And so I think it's going to be a radical change because I talked to so many parents, whereas just 6 months ago, they said, my kid had straight A's. He volunteered to take the SAT. He had a perfect score. He didn't get into Princeton. And now it is, thank God he didn't get, my next kid's not even going to apply there. And I think that's going to be very good, especially if we look at trade schools for half the pop, you know, trade schools, electricians, plumbers, and we get rid of this Western idea of prolonged adolescence where you kind of go to college, you kind of take some courses, you drop out a semester, you come back, you protest, you don't really study, and then all of a sudden you've consumed your mid-20s. And these catalysts that are so important for the West of getting married, having children, buying a home, all of the catalysts for traditionalism and responsibility, we put them off into your 40s or late 30s. And it would be good to get back to you know, 18, 19, 20 adulthood rather than these prolonged adolescence we see every night on television.
I can't stand it when people say we need a war, because I always think, well, good luck to you if you have to fight in one. But it was an interesting part of your book is the regret part, that after an annihilation, the annihilator will feel regret and they will try and justify it to themselves. But it then means that after an annihilation, you do have the possibility of a sustained period of moral good. And do you worry that we're getting to a phase now where without some terrible annihilation, we might not have the moral drive to stop it?
I don't know. I mean, 9/11, there was a remarkable cohesion in the United States, and we upped the defense budget, and that was the last period where we had 2.1 fertility. Now we have 1.7, a precipitous drop, but there was a sense of confidence because of that disaster. And I think there are people in the United States from both sides, when they look at TikTok or they look at the serial threats of Taiwan or they look at the Uyghurs, that they're starting to see China as more of an existential threat. And China wants to do something to the United States that's not good. And it has 1.4 billion people. It's in a fanatic rate to build nuclear weapons. Its navy is bigger than ours now. And it doesn't like us. And it wants to dethrone us. And it's trying to enlist Russia, Iran, North Korea, trying to turn Qatar, Turkey, even India against us. So I think that's really shaken people up in the United States. So I think in the next administration, even if it's a Democratic administration, I think there will be people who say that we have to start rearming, we've got to get our financial house in order, and we've got people in the world that are going to go to every one of our allies. They're going to go to South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, the Philippines, and they're going to say, look, the Chinese are going to go to them and say, the United States is going to get you in trouble. They're a declining power. Where are they? You're near us now, and we can make a deal with you. But if you persist in being anti-Chinese and you count on these people, it's kind of like everybody on the walls of Constantinople thinking that the Venetian fleet is going to come and save them from the Ottomans, or the Carthaginians saying, oh, the Macedonians will come to the rear of the Romans. Don't worry. If you continue to do that, you're going to be in big trouble because they will not help you and you're not under their nuclear umbrella. And so that's our big worry. I think a lot of people, we have to reassure countries on the front lines around China that their way of life will be protected and aided by the United States. And I think that's very different than going into illiberal regimes and saying, we're going to change you. And we're going to use force to force you be like. I think we're drawing a line now, and we're saying these are the countries that matter, and the Chinese are trying to divorce them from the West or bribe them or threaten them, and we're going to give them reassurance. And we can't do that unless we stabilize our finances and vastly increase our defense budget to re-achieve deterrence, and we got to do something about the recruitment. That's something that we do not talk about abroad, but my God, when you go speak to people and some woman, 60, raises her hand off topic and says, my grandson is 18, his father fought in Iraq, his grandfather fought in the first Gulf War, his great-grandfather fought in Korea and Vietnam, and he's not going into the military. And you say, why? And he said, well, look at Afghanistan, he'll get killed for nothing. Look at Iraq, look at this, and then he's not going to get promoted. And General Milley said he was going to investigate white privilege throughout the ranks. And then he had a report and they didn't find any, but he didn't apologize to my son. Or they'll say, my husband had COVID 3 times and they drummed him out of the military for not getting a booster. And so that is a big problem, because if we lose that demographic, then we're not going to have people who say, I want to go over to whether you like it or not, these are the people who go into god-awful Fallujah and fight door-to-door, and they're not joining. They've had it. And it's kind of the military version of this red state, blue state decoupling. And so we're becoming two societies in the United States, but The military cannot afford that. And I think there, if you look at the commercials, just to finish this rant, 6 months ago, we had pregnant women in air suits and saying, this is the new, we have pregnancy accommodations with new uniforms. And then it was all about diversity and vocational training. And now suddenly there's people jumping out of helicopters and they're running into battle and you can hear explosions. And this is your new military. Be all you can be again. So they don't want to admit it, but the military is aware that if you alienate that traditional family, you're going to be in big trouble because the world depends on those particular lower and middle class, tend to be rural, tend to be more southern, and they tend to be more white, to be frank. And if you ostracize them and call them deplorables or clingers, whatever you do, they're not going to join. And yet they're the people who go all around the world in its worst places.
Finally, Victor, last time we spoke at the end, you were sounding quite optimistic, I think, about civil war, or that you don't think there'll be a civil war because of the asymmetry between the capable people who would want order and the incapable people who would want disorder. I don't know if you've seen this new Civil War film. It's very ridiculous.
No, I just read about it. I haven't seen it, but I've read it extensively.
Well, I wouldn't bother if I were you. But, I mean, your view has not changed in the last however many weeks it is since we last spoke.
I've been blessed because I live on this farm and then I go to Stanford during the week. And I've done that for 20 years. And when I'm here in the central San Joaquin Valley, I see farmers. I just talked to a fellow who's a Basque. He came here with nothing from the border of France and Spain. He owns 12,000 acres of almonds. And I rent to him and I look at the almond orchard and it's the most sophisticated, highly productive orchard in the world. And this is an immigrant that didn't speak English when he got here. And when I see electricians and plumbers and tractor mechanics and construction people, they're the most capable people in the world. I can't believe how. I have a 150-year-old house, and I had a Mexican-American friend of mine with his friend, and they looked at it and said, this is a fire trap, you can't do it, and they rewired the entire house. And I can't believe it, in the most sophisticated wiring possible. And they did it on weekends. And so when I go to Stanford, I don't see that confidence, and I don't see that degree of competence either in the faculty or the students, and they're almost like they're drones, they're helpless. And yet these people are, they're mechanics, they have children, they own their home, they're optimistic, they all own firearms, and they're not bashful about it. It hasn't changed, I'm saying, in 200 years in this part of America. And we're still the majority. And that I think you can see that because the left understands that. And so their route to political power is to control the media, the corporate boardroom, academia, the foundations, K-12, entertainment, in lieu of popular support. So all of these issues that they, this agendas they have, they're pushed by this bicoastal elite through institutional power, and they have a lot more money due to globalization, but they understand that they have to be deceptive or they can't be transparent about their agenda because the people don't want it. It's just amazing, just to finish, that with all the propaganda about Gaza and the hatred of Israel in the media and the academic, I was just looking at a poll, almost 70% of Americans favor Israel. I can't believe that's possible because of the institutional bias that we have that's fed to the American people. But that's, I think it's just an innate sense that this practical American says, one side has got elections, one side doesn't. One side decapitates, mutilates, mass rapes, the other side doesn't. And that's all they need to know. And it's very determinative and blunt. And that's always been our great strength. This is, I think, rural, practical, middle-class America, and not our elites.
Well, on that, I think, finally, optimistic note, thank you very much, Victor Davis Hanson. You are a great shatterer of delusions, and we are very grateful for you coming on the Americano podcast.
Well, thank you, Freddie. I enjoyed it a great deal.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Farose, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review
of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.